This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about the abortion issue and how to frame it and whether and how to let some shades of gray into the picture. With me to talk about this issue is Krista Jacob, the editor of a provocative new book entitled Abortion Under Attack. Krista Jacob, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You know, with that title, I was expecting a different kind of book because I thought it was going to list the numerous right-wing assaults on abortion and this legislation and that. In a way, the title is a misnomer, I would suggest to you, because I think it's more about, you know, how do we talk about abortion, though that's in the subhead there, I see. But it's am I wrong about that?
No, you're not. You're exactly right. Actually, the publisher was the one who decided to go with this title. When I had initially put together the call for contributions and circulated it and tried to get writers for the book, I had entitled it Abortion Evolution, because what I wanted to highlight here was all the ways in which the abortion issue and debate is changing as our society changes. But there's other people working for the publisher who have other issues that they're thinking about, such as marketing and how to attract people's attention.
Was that a fight you had?
A small one, yes.
You write in your introduction that at the risk of airing dirty laundry, you want to talk about some of the shades of gray in the abortion discussion in this country, especially among women who are feminist, who identify in one capacity or another as pro-choice, though some prefer different terminology than that. What is some of that dirty laundry?
Well, I worked as an abortion counselor, and that was really the catalyst for me and wanting to put this book out there. What I found when I worked as an abortion counselor is that there are many, many women and couples who come into the clinic and decide to terminate a pregnancy who are not very political people, or maybe they are political, but they are surprised by the conflicted and complex feelings that their abortion brings up for them. And I think that one of the mistakes the reproductive rights movement has made is by oversimplifying the issue. I think the slogans, the My Body, My Choice, certainly have a place, but I don't think that they're reflective of the diversity of the abortion experience. I counseled pro-life women who had abortions. I counseled women from various racial and ethnic, cultural, economic backgrounds who had other considerations that we often don't hear the reproductive rights movement talk about. And so I wanted to put that out there.
Well, let's talk about the conservative people you counseled, the mm-hmm. pro-life people. How frequently would you have someone in there who was politically opposed to abortion, and how would they grapple with the situation that put them in?
I remember two women in particular who had actually protested in front of our clinic.
Before or after their abortion?
Before their mm-hmm. abortion. As a counselor, you work with a person where they're at within their worldview. I wasn't there to get into a political debate with them. I was there to hear them talk about why they were making the decision that they were making, to help them own it, which is another important piece of it, and to help them to connect them with resources for when they leave.
And how did they own it?
Well, sometimes women who are really struggling with the morality or the politics of what abortion is and what it means, they would say things like, well, I just feel like I'm probably going to miscarry. Or they would say something that would absolve them of the responsibility of making that choice. And I always reaffirmed to them that, because we did an ultrasound before their procedure, that we had no reason to believe that they were going to miscarry, that the pregnancy was very much intact, and we had no reason to believe it wasn't going to come to fruition at that point. Because you didn't want people leaving the clinic thinking they had sort of had an abortion and sort of not had an abortion, because obviously that's counterproductive for healing and other reasons.
You write that the first time this happened to you, you felt like violating your oath of confidence to your clients.
That's right. I was younger when I first started the work and a little bit more black and white in my view, and I was furious. And I felt that it was hypocritical and that they would try to take away this right from people yet use it for themselves. And yeah, absolutely. I remember having that kind of strong reaction. And as I got a little bit older, I didn't have quite as strong feelings against that.
I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm speaking with Krista Jacob, author of a new book, Abortion Under Attack. The book is not so much about the hypocrisy of so-called pro-life women who end up having an abortion despite their political beliefs. It's really, if I might summarize, about women who are feminists who, some of them anyway, did not find the experience of having an abortion easy or necessarily deriving a sense of liberation from it. That sense that there's more complicated emotions involved in this procedure seems to run through many of the accounts. You have individuals who relay their own personal experiences, one of them quite harrowing, a woman who had RU-46 a little late in the game and had intense traumatic bleeding and did not come out of that experience feeling very good whatsoever. But the sense of shame, you know, I first was acquainted, I've known a few women who had abortions, but the sense of shame that came from it, I first encountered in a poetry class I took a little more than 20 years ago. There was a young woman in the class who wrote this poem. I assume it was about her own experience. It was in the first person, and just about how horrible she felt after having the abortion. And I think she was a pretty liberal person politically and in favor of abortion. So that struck me then, that maybe we're not really allowing into the conversation, the political conversation, when we have it about abortion, the range of complicated feelings that come sometimes.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the statistics estimate that 42% of women in this country alone will have one abortion. So that's, you know, that's a lot of women out
there. More than 40%.
Yes, more than 40%. And because of the stigma against abortion, many women don't talk about it because, you know, obviously they have a lot of shame and guilt about it. But I think that there's a lot of politically awake or politically aware women who don't talk about it because they feel that if they talk about the shades of gray, the complexities, the guilt, the grief, the remorse, all those kinds of feelings, that that somehow means that they're not a supporter of legal abortion or that they're not pro-choice. And, you know, I've had the opportunity in my activism and work to sit down and talk with pro-life women, not in the abortion clinic, but at conferences and at political events, in an attempt to try to build bridges and understand each other's point of view. And I can say that almost the majority of these women have had abortions and have had very bad abortion experiences. And some are seeking atonement through their pro-life political activism. And this concerns me because some of the restrictions that have been imposed at the various abortion clinics have actually forced clinics to close their counseling programs. And so there are many clinics that provide abortion where there's either no counseling or very limited counseling available. And I'm concerned that this is fertile ground for the pro-life movement, that you're going to have a lot of women and their male partners who are going to leave there feeling very much alone, very damaged, not having any tools or resources for processing any grief they may have. And I think that many will be drawn to the pro-life movement for support.
Krista Jacob, there's a chapter in here written by another counselor at a clinic who was so busy, ultimately she only sometimes would have 5 minutes with each or sometimes had to talk with 10 women at a time if they were, you know, at overflow capacity, seeing 100 women a day. I think the statistic was there. That isn't a satisfying experience either.
No, not at all.
And the slippery slope, though, I mean, the reason why some of the second wave pro-choice advocates don't want some of this dirty laundry aired is they think any discussion of it, as you suggested, gives fodder to the right. And so how did you wrestle with that problem in getting together this book that raises some of these questions?
I think that's a good question. I mean, as I quote my friend Peg Johnston in the book, and she always says, the truth is more solid ground to stand on, and I do believe it's the truth. I also think, you know, the pro-life movement is in full swing. It's very strong. It's well-organized at the grassroots level, yet it's also highly funded, very well-funded movement. And it's sort of unique in that regard, that it's so well-organized at both levels. But they have, the pro-life movement has set the terms of the debate for far too long. And as we have lost ground and had fewer victories, we have become reactive rather than proactive. We as a movement have completely allowed them, and they've also been very sophisticated in their technique, but we've allowed them to have a monopoly on the religious discourse when there are many, many people of faith who are pro-choice and who have abortions and who are pro-choice because of their faith, not in spite of their faith. And I feel like this is a way that we can do that, that we can be proactive, that we can own this and say, let's explore this further in an intelligent way. Charlotte Taft, a mentor of mine, always refers to the pro-life movement. She uses the metaphor of ants at the picnic. And she says, whatever theoretical crumbs we leave behind, that's what they go for. And that's really what they have over the last decade. They've done a lot of stuff on post-abortion stress syndrome, and which is something that's not supported by any, you know, psychological association. But they've really gone with that, and that's in the mainstream, and there are many people who have bought into that.
You have a chapter by Frances Kissling, who is Catholics for a Free Choice, one of the leaders or founders, I think, of that organization for the last many years. She raises the question of whether the language of the pro-choice movement has been imprecise or inadequate in some moral discourse about the fetus. Mm-hmm. And the rights of the fetus or the status of the fetus. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I do. I think that we, again, our movement has tried to sweep that under the rug and say, well, it's nothing, or it's not a life. And that's fine. There are many people who believe that. But I think that there are many more people, especially with all the advances made in technology, we're seeing more early on in embryonic and fetal development.
I mean, I know when you go in and you see the ultrasound, I mean, you can see early on that there's something beating in there.
That's right, that there's cardiac motion. That's right. And the pro-life movement calls it a heartbeat, which isn't medically accurate because it's not a heart yet. But absolutely, there is cardiac motion going on, and women see that before they have their abortion. And women have mixed feelings about that. And, you know, you even see early, I mean, you see fetal development at 10 and 11 weeks once the pregnancy's been removed from the uterus. And there are many women who find comfort in looking at the pregnancy tissue after their abortion as a way to connect more to what that was, and as a way to create a better understanding for themselves about what they just did and what their abortion means. And there are other women who don't want to see that at all. I'm actually working on an essay right now called A Womb with a View, in which I'm looking at how technology has given us more information about what's going on in embryonic development, but also how the pro-life movement has used technology to further humanize the embryo and fetus.
A womb with a view, yeah. I mean, that gets really to the problem, though, on those ultrasounds and with this technology, that if you grant that, you know, there is a fetus there, there's something beating, if there isn't an intervention, odds are that fetus is going to grow into a baby, a human being. Then does that pull the rug out from under the pro-choice argument?
Absolutely not, because I think that even the women who grapple with the abortion and maybe feel that it's a life, they still do draw a distinction between an embryo and a baby. And also, what I want to say is that women don't choose to have abortions because they don't think it's a life. They choose to necessarily. They choose to have abortions because they can't afford to raise a child, because maybe they've been left by the man that they became pregnant with. Maybe they have a special needs child at no home that they're caring for, and they simply don't have the resources or the ability to care for another child. Maybe they'll lose their job if they're pregnant. The experience of being pregnant and of birthing a child and raising a child require a lot from a person, and there are many people who simply don't have the tools and resources to do that. And so for some women who really grapple deeply with the morality of abortion and may even feel that they're killing a life, they're sort of choosing the lesser of the two evils. They feel that they have to be a parent to the children that they have now, and so they're choosing that over having another child.
Yes, the complexities, the different individual cases come clear in this book, Krista Jacob, your book, Abortion Under Attack. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor of the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. You've been a counselor, as you said before, at clinics. How would you comfort a woman who may be listening to this program right now, who's had abortion, remembers the experience, is remembering feelings right now of ambiguity and some sense of feeling bad about it?
Well, I would really encourage her to find a safe person to talk with about it, whether it be a therapist or a safe clergy person. There's a website, abortionconversation.com. I'm on the board of this organization, and there are a number of resources for women and couples who are still processing unresolved feelings that may be left from their abortion. So if they have access to the internet, I recommend that they go there, because it's a good starting point for somebody. Another thing that I wanted to add about the abortion experience is that I often told women and their male partner, if he was involved, that they're having to make a decision based on a lot of unknowns. They don't know if they are going to miscarry the next week. They don't know, you know, 1 in 100 pregnancies end after 20 weeks. You don't necessarily know for sure that it's going to come to fruition. You don't know that you're going to have a child that's healthy. You may have a child with special needs. I mean, there's a lot of aspects of this that they're just that are unknowable at that point. And I think that in and of itself can spark ambivalent feelings for a person. The wondering, the not knowing. Would it have been a male? Would it have been a boy? Would it have been a girl? Would they have, you know, would the pregnancy have come to term, et cetera?
One of the haunting chapters in this book, or a discussion in it, I think, is in one of your chapters, you talk of a friend of yours who was pregnant and was planning on taking the fetus to term, but the fetus had a syndrome, Edwards mm-hmm. syndrome, I think, that I'd never heard of before. Mm-hmm. The friend had an abortion and was terribly grief-stricken, but was grief-stricken for a particular reason. Can you talk about that?
Oh, she felt guilty because they did a baptism after she delivered her baby. They did a baptism, and she had named the child, she gave the child a different name than what she had originally planned to name her baby. And that particular piece of that experience was very painful for her, because she felt that she negated that child by not doing that.
Mm-hmm. Is there a way that you recommend for people to deal with the fetus that has been aborted to make it less traumatic? I mean, there are some who do give a name to the fetus that's been aborted. Is that standard, or what would you recommend?
I think that whatever kind of ritual makes sense to them within their worldview, whether it be a baptism or a naming, or I can even remember women who would plant trees in mm-hmm. honor, whatever works for them within like their own religious views. I also talk in my introduction about a Catholic woman who came into the clinic who had an early abortion. I believe it was 6 or 7 weeks, and her priest took her to the clinic and performed a mock baptism. And that's not something that is going to sit well with many pro-choice activists when they hear that sort of thing.
On the other hand, I mean, I read that twice, because the first time I thought, well, this priest is being really hypocritical. And then I read it again and said, well, this priest is giving comfort to one of the people in his church.
That's absolutely right.
There's some back and forth cross currents in this book that make reading the book quite interesting. Krista Jacob, the book is called Abortion Under Attack. And that is, there is, with some authors of chapters, a moralistic approach, especially about women who have multiple abortions. There's one woman who said she just feels like we in the pro-choice movement need to distinguish between those who have an abortion for exigent purposes and those who come back for their third or fourth. And even in one chapter, it's mentioned that almost every clinic knows of someone who's come in for like 24 abortions,
mm-hmm.
which was something that I'd really never heard of. And then there are other people writing and saying, you know, women don't need to be spanked because they have more than one abortion.
That's right.
And so you have both of those things going on, and I know as the editor, editors make conscious choices. Usually contradictions don't sneak in. Why did you decide to have those cross currents going on?
Well, I think it's reflective of the different views about abortion. There are people who think, well, you do it once, you made your mistake, but you need to learn from it and take more control of your life in the future. And there's other people who say, no, you know, not all of us feel that abortion is a bad thing, or also that many women who have multiple abortions are doing so because they have out-of-control lives. There's a correlation between women who have multiple abortions and a history of sexual abuse. I'm thinking of the women that I counseled who had had 10, 11, 12, 13 abortions. Many were severely low-income women, prostituted women, women who lived on Indian reservations and simply just didn't have the resources to prevent a pregnancy.
Hmm. I saw that some don't even have the resources to pay for the pill at $35 or $40 or $50 a month or whatever that is.
That's right.
So
that's right.
Another issue that was complicated was this question of sex selection and the technology that you can do an amniocentesis, find out the sex of the fetus and decide to abort because you want, well, a boy or less commonly, I think, a girl. I mean, in India, they abort girls all the time with this technology.
Mm-hmm. In China, too.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And how tricky is that in the U.S. Context?
Absolutely. I mean, it is complex, isn't it? It raises a number of different questions. And the thing is that abortion isn't always going to be used for good, or good as we would define it. But I think the reality of women's lives is that they have to grapple with the circumstances of their life. So if they are pregnant with a girl, and in some cultures this could mean that they'll be shunned, maybe taken away from their children they already have, removed from the family, etc. They're the ones who have to grapple with that, not me, not anybody else who might be critical of them. And so it's also, when women have abortions because they live in poverty, that to me is equally as disconcerting, that they would have chosen to bring that pregnancy to term if they had had the financial resources that they needed to do so. I think that shows the ways in which our culture fails women and children, and why those failures force women to make the decision to have an abortion.
I'm speaking with Christy Jacob. Her new book, Abortion Under Attack. How'd you decide to pick the particular authors that you chose? You got something like a couple hundred submissions, it sounded like, there.
Mm-hmm.
And so how'd you make your selections?
I was looking for people who wanted to look at the nuances of abortion, and I was looking for people who wanted to change the rhetoric, who wanted to challenge the current rhetoric of both movements, pro-choice movement and the pro-life movement. And I was looking for essays that were that reflected cultural diversity and how that shaped an individual's opinions about abortion and their feelings about their abortion experience.
We'll talk a little bit more about the diversity and how that impacts on people's decisions. I know you say a lot of people of color, women of color, have different experiences and different reactions to the whole term freedom of choice, and there are other issues that they're also wrestling with that may not make, you know, the choice movement the movement they want to enter. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, many women of color are repelled by the notion of choice. Many feel that they're not making a choice. Choice sounds a little bit like a luxury. It sounds like you have this array of equally appealing options, and that's not how many women experience abortion. So if you talk about a woman making the decision to have an abortion because she simply can't afford to be pregnant or to raise another child, it doesn't feel like much of a choice to her. Also, as I mentioned earlier, many women are pregnant because their lives are out of control economically, etc. Maybe they're in a physically abusive relationship. Maybe they have issues from childhood that they haven't had the opportunity to work through yet. And so they feel that they are there because of a lack of control and choice in their life. And so the choice rhetoric is not very reflective of their experience, which is why I have an essay in there from the Asian Communities for Reproductive Justice. They don't use choice rhetoric. They talk about it in terms of reproductive justice, and they also cast a wide net. They connect the issue of reproductive justice to a number of issues, immigrant rights, subsidized child care, welfare rights, even toxins in the environment, which was another thing that really appealed to me, was to say, okay, if we're trying to make our movement more plural, if we're trying to make it more inclusive and sort of breathe some life, so to speak, into our movement, one of the best ways we can do that is cast a wide net and say, okay, if you're opposed to abortion, be part of a movement that increases access to birth control for low-income women.
This idea about changing the rhetoric from choice to reproductive justice runs through a couple of the essays in the book, and I was introduced to it most recently by Loretta Ross, who gave a talk in Madison, Wisconsin in the fall of 2006. She's with a group called Sister Song, I think, and just a wonderful, powerful speaker and thinker and activist. But she stressed the point that it's not just a luxury of choice, that there are all sorts of circumstances that impact, and that we're talking about women who want to have need to have abortions or want to have a child and want to do both in a safe environment at a time when they can handle both of those.
You know, decisions. Anecdotally, I can say that as welfare became more and more under attack, initially in the Clinton administration and then continuing so under the Bush administration, I saw more and more women say, "I'm having an abortion because I don't get any more benefits. The safety net that welfare had provided for many women was almost completely removed, and subsequently women were having to choose to not carry their pregnancies to term."
Krista Jacob, what reactions have you had from, you know, kind of hardline second waivers like Ellie Smeal or Katha Pollitt, both of whom I love? I think they do great work, but I know they tend to be pretty adamant on this and think that you're letting the camel into the tent.
I've certainly heard that, and I respect that opinion. I think that their opinions are shaped by their generational experiences. Many of the second wave women knew women who died from having illegal abortions. They knew women who lost their fertility as a result of having an illegal, unsafe, unsanitary abortion. I know a woman who was raped by the abortionist before he did the abortion because she was already committing something illegal, so he knew that it was very unlikely she was going to report the sexual assault.
Wow, that's a story.
Women were very, very vulnerable during that time, and I think that created a particular kind of worldview that's much more maybe black and white or militant. I don't mean to use negative words because I really honestly respect it. But I think, you know, for someone like myself who's come of age post-Roe, I don't know anyone who's died from an illegal abortion or had an act of violence committed against them by a physician before the abortion. But I know a lot of women who have unresolved feelings. And as I say in my introduction, I believe that we have as much right to have ambivalence about the feelings about abortion or our own abortion experience as we do to have access to a safe and legal and dignified abortion.
That's about freedom, too. Krista Jacob, how can people get a copy of your book, and what other websites would you steer people to?
Well, there's my website, www.kristajacob.com. I also...
That's Krista, K-R-I-S-T-A Jacob, J-A-C-O-B.
Also, www.abortionconversation.com, which I referred to earlier, in collaboration with Peg Johnson and Grayson Debsey, I just put together a website, www.momdadimpregnant.com. It's a resource for teens who are coping with unplanned pregnancies and how to – it's a resource for both teens and their parents, because we feel that ultimately it's much better when the parents are involved in the decision, when the family is supportive. I did a reading at Room One's Own in Madison, Wisconsin recently, and my book is available there. Any independent bookstore should be able to get the book for you.
Well, that's great. Krista Jacob, thanks so much for being my guest today. The book, again, Abortion Under Attack.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.